for me, a challenging privilege for me, to preach through 1 Samuel over this last term. And what we're doing for these next few Sundays in the evenings is we're going to be looking at some of the Psalms that relate to some of the narrative as we were tracking it through 1 Samuel. So as you read in the inspired editorial comment at the top of the psalm, just before verse 1, and you know, if you read in a French Bible, it would have been verse 1, and I think they have a point. It says, to the choir master, according to do not destroy, a miktam, I guess that's a musical term, of David. And look when he wrote it. When Saul sent men to watch his house in order to kill him. You can read about that later in 1 Samuel 19 if you want a reminder of the circumstances there. But it's not long after David had slain the giant Goliath in faithful service to his king and to his God. Saul's son Jonathan saw a fine man and a fine successor to the throne in David. But Saul was consumed with bitter jealousy vis-a-vis David because of that song that the women all over the country were singing, that Saul has killed his thousands, but David, his tens of thousands. And that was more than Saul could handle. And yet the writing had been on the wall since chapter 13. Samuel clearly said it. You've set to one side the clear command of God, and so God, as it were, is going to set you aside as king over his people. And so what for the bulk of the narrative of 1 Samuel is rolling out is that word of judgment against Saul's reign and the ascendancy of David. But David isn't yet king. He doesn't get officially recognized as king and as the Lord's anointed over Israel until you get into 2 Samuel. So in one sense, he's a nobody with extraordinary promise, and Saul knows it and is livid because of it and has thrown spears at David. You read about that in 1 Samuel chapter 18. So David is running for his life. But before he runs, he's at home and he's being watched. And at the first opportunity to take his life, Saul's men are instructed to do so. Now the question is this: how, if that is your predicament, someone with an army behind him, with men serving him who are out for your life, how do you sing aloud of God's steadfast love for you? God has allowed this to happen. God, the psalm could read, God, what are you playing at? God, I can't take this anymore. Serving you is proving far too costly. I'm off. How do you worship and praise the steadfast love of God when God has allowed your enemies to seek after your life? So, this should be instructive for us. How do you worship when life gets pretty much as tough as it can possibly get? How do you worship? Now, I said it's been a challenging privilege for me. because I need to read this and in many ways weep. Let's look at what the worshipper does. First of all, in verses 1 and 2, it's dependency, isn't it? It's an honest description of his predicament to God. He's speaking to God and he's depending on him. Deliver me from my enemies, O my God. I depend on you, God, for protection against my enemies. Protect me from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who work evil, and save me from bloodthirsty men. Now, I don't know what your tendency is to do when you feel under pressure. Perhaps you double down in your self-sufficiency. I spoke to one man, Christian man actually, who said that oftentimes when he walks into a room and he's not sure how people are disposed towards him, he thinks to himself, you can stand tall, you got a 2-1 from Bristol University. And in that sense, perhaps we underestimate the enmity of the enemy. I mean, what is a 2-1 from Bristol going to do if someone's out to get you for your life? Or perhaps we might tend to exaggerate and seek a sympathy vote from men. Look at me, I'm suffering, I'm hurting so badly. I could fall into both of those camps depending on the day of the week. David does neither. Look at his circumstances. They are bad. Go back to that, the editorial note again. By the way, books one and two of the Psalms, and we are in book two of the Psalms here. So they are compiled into five books, the Psalms. And from 42, I think up to 80, no, 42 up to, where would it be now? Where is book 2 take us up to? 72. Psalms 42 to 72 are book 2 of the Psalms. And an Old Testament scholar, Gleason Archer, says that in all likelihood, books 1 and 2 of the Psalms were compiled during David's lifetime. So it's as if David has emailed the editorial team and he said, look guys, this one I wrote when Saul was out to get me and sent men to watch my house at night. Let's sing this one. Perhaps to Do Not Destroy, his favorite tune. But also, the editorial note reads, when Saul sent men to watch his house in order to kill him. David's not exaggerating. And David's not underestimating. The fact is, there are enemies who are baying for his blood. It's an honest description. And because of that honest description of his circumstances, he recognizes that he needs to depend on his God. 3 to 5. In verses 3 to 5, urgency. Urgency and a plea for justice. Look what he says. They lie in wait for my life. Fierce men stir up strife against me. Why? For no transgression or sin of mine, O Lord. For no fault of mine, they run and make ready. It's not fair. Awake, come to meet me and see. Look what they're doing, Lord. See it. Meet me. He seeks God's presence for justice. Rouse yourself, to punish all the nations, he says in verse 5. Spare none of those who treacherously plot evil. Now, at the beginning of verse 5, he says, you, Lord God of hosts, are God of Israel. Now, Lord God of hosts, some translations would translate that God of armies. Saul has an army. But Saul's army is nothing compared to the celestial armies of the Lord. So what David is saying is, I know that you can write this. You can sort this out. You made heaven and earth. Saul is a flesh and blood man like me. He's out to get me. It's pretty scary. The men come at night to watch my house. They want me dead. But I'm looking to you because I know that you are stronger by far. You are the Lord of hosts, no other. You are the God of Israel. I'm looking to you. But it's curious that he says, rouse yourself to punish all the nations. I wonder if you noticed that. I wonder if there's a question in your mind. If Saul is the one who's out to get him, why is he bringing the nations into it? This is an internal issue. The king of Israel wants to get rid of the soon-to-be king of Israel. So what have the nations got to do with it? And it comes back. It comes back later on in the psalm, that theme of the nations, verse 8. But you, O Lord, laugh at them. You hold all the nations in derision. I think what's going on is this. Insofar as Saul is out to get the man who the Lord has had anointed by the prophet Samuel to be the king of Israel, and Saul's not having it, Saul is against the will of the Lord. Then he is aligning himself with the nations who rage against God. Psalm 2, why do the nations rage? They say, let's throw off their ropes, cast off the chains of God and his anointed. And Saul is effectively living out solidarity with the pagan nations, which should make us think twice, shouldn't it? Before being out to get a brother for whom Jesus died. That is a game we can't afford to play. I can't, you can't. Saul is a living and dying warning to us. Another question I have. Spare none of those, he says, who treacherously plot evil in verse 5. But in verse 11, he says, kill them not, lest my people forget. So what is it to be, David? Do you want them all to die? Or do you want them all to not die? What's going on? I think what's going on is this. Spare none of those who treacherously plot evil. He's referring to the nations. And David, I think, has depersonalized his issue with Saul. Does that make sense? He is not seeing Saul as his enemy. He's seeing Saul's solidarity with the nations and the nations as the enemy. And he's saying, as far as the nations are concerned, who are opposed to you, Lord, spare none. But then when he says, kill them not, he is giving voice. He is giving voice to his concern that everybody, as we've been singing already in this service, that everybody, that every knee should bow, that everyone should recognize the Lord, the God of Israel. He says, kill them not, lest my people forget. Make them totter by your power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. Insofar as they stand against you, Lord, take their knees out, so that they can recognize that you are Lord and that their rebellion against you is nothing short of ridiculous given who you are and who they are not. Okay, now when we get into verses 6 and 7, we have something that gets repeated. 6 and 7 gets repeated almost word for word in verses 14 and 15. Do you see that? Each evening they come back, howling like dogs and prowling about the city. There they are, bellowing with their mouths, with swords in their lips, for who, they think, will hear us? And let's say this. Saul has expressed his solidarity with the nations. But Saul is also, with his men, expressing beastly and brazen violence against David. Likened to a dog. He's been likened to pagan nations, now likened to a dog. Why? Because Saul is effectively denying God's presence. Who's gonna see us? Who's gonna hear us? We're gonna get away with it. We're gonna get away with it. It's ugly. So I want to say this: see the ugly, the ugliness of this attack on David and on the Lord's people generally from the nations. See the ugliness. But as you see the ugliness, focus on God, which is what David proceeds to do in verses 8 following. See the ugly, but focus on God. Now that is going to be a saving lesson for us. See the ugly, but focus on God. When I was in my late teens, I had a man from down the road at night with his dog come at me with his hand cupped, looking like he wanted to see my blood spill on the path that ran through the park. It was quite scary. It was ugly. But I can't say, as I focused on God, at that point in time. It was before my conversion. It was just plain scary. And I think because of that plain scariness, there's a lot of kids in London packing knives. Don't attack the ugly with the ugly. Focus on God. But you, O Lord, laugh at them. You hold all the nations in derision. Oh, my strength, I will watch for you, verse 9. For you, O God, are my fortress. My God in his steadfast love will meet me. Doesn't feel like it now, but I'm trusting him and I know he will meet me. I'm waiting for him. And ultimately, God will let me look in triumph on my enemies. But interestingly, once Saul has died, David does not gloat over Saul. He weeps over Saul. So again, David's enemy, first and foremost, isn't Saul. He's thinking further afield. He's thinking in terms of God's glory. He's thinking in terms of God's vindication over the nations who rebel against him. That's a godly man. His squabble is not parochial. God in his steadfast love will meet me. God will let me look in triumph on my enemies. Will you focus on the perfectly faithful power, love, and justice of God in your struggle, in your pain? Will you focus on the steadfast love that derides the nations and protects and meets every promise of his word and promises vindication to the one who prays? And it's funny how, even in the context of close family relationships, you can be having a struggle And someone could ask you the question, did you pray together about it? And oftentimes the answer comes back, well, no, we didn't. That's a core expression of our trust in the steadfast love of God, to actually go to him in prayer with that particular struggle that we're going through in that particular moment. Go to God. He laughs at the enmity of our enemies. He will triumph and we will see it. So David doesn't have to get vindictive. And he's not vindictive in verse 11 following. Kill them not, lest my people forget. Make them totter by your power and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. Does this sound a little vindictive, verse 12? For the sin of their mouths, the words of their lips, let them be trapped in their pride. For the cursing and lies that they utter, consume them in wrath, consume them till they are no more, that they may know that God rules over Jacob to the ends of the earth. Again, I don't think this is David being vindictive. I think this is David being zealous for the glory of God. He wants God's name to be hallowed even on the lips of his enemies. As God opposes their pride, brings them low, and forces them to recognize that he is the God of Jacob to the ends of the earth. When you think God of Jacob, think back, Genesis, towards the end of Genesis. Jacob, his son Joseph, has had these life-saving dreams for all the surrounding nations of Egypt. And then Jacob comes to Egypt and is recognized by Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to be a man who serves a true and living God. And he's given land there. These nations will, according to the promise of God's word, be brought into a humble recognition of who God is to the ends of the earth. So we have that verse, that theme repeated, verse 14. Each evening they come back, howling like dogs. Again, we're seeing the ugly. But what are we doing this time? What are we doing this time? See the ugly, but worship God. So before we had see the ugly, but focus on God. Now we have see the ugly, but worship God. And David says, I will sing of your strength. I will sing aloud of your steadfast love in the morning. I'm going to worship you, Lord. You've been to me a fortress and a refuge in the day of my distress. Oh, my strength, I will sing praises to you. You think, as David calls to mind just who God is in reality, even though there's another reality that speaks of the enmity of his foes, but as David calls to mind who God is, God's doing him good. He's being comforted. And it's night, and his enemies are all around him. And in one sense, David doesn't know whether he will see the light of the next day. So how poignant that he says, I will sing of your steadfast love in the morning. If I live to see another day, Lord, I'm going to praise you. That's my first priority. Before I even think to save my own neck, no, I'm going to praise you, God. I'm going to sing. That's what I'm going to do. That's a crazy resolution in one sense. It's a spiritual resolution. It's supernatural. And actually, remember, those opponents of David, they're opposing God. And what chance do they have? Those dogs. I remember an illustration from a pastor in London, a church that we used to attend. And he had been on a holiday to Norway and to see the Northern Lights, and was told about how they used to kill wolves back in the day in Norway. And what they would do is they would get some juice from meat and some fat, and they would mix it up with snow, pack it around a dagger, and they would place the dagger in the snow. And then along comes the wolf, thinking, here's a tasty bit of nourishment for me, and he starts licking the snow, the fat-infused snow. But as he licks, he begins to lick, his tongue gets numbed by the coldness of the snow, and then progressively the dagger is revealed, but he carries on licking, and he can't feel that he's slowly bleeding to death. That's a grim picture. But, like, our enmity against God's people, against God himself, is just going to cause us slowly to die. It's pointless. But be comforted, people of God. Trust in your God. The enmity against you is futile. I don't know what you're scared of, whether it's, you know, the politically correct, the LGBTQ plus, goodness knows, whether it's those who would hound you if you live in Wales for spanking your children, whether, I don't know what it is. What would it be that you're scared of, paranoid about? Death. I want to finish by sharing with you some words from a man who faced death in ways that we may, the threat of death, that is, in ways that we may never. Joseph Son. Now, he lived in Romania under that communist regime, and in 1977 he was under arrest. And he was being told that he must not continue to preach the truth about Jesus. Otherwise, he would be incarcerated and he might die. He'd be tortured. He had been tortured. He had been beaten already. He calmly says to the member of the secret police who is interrogating him and threatening him, he says, "Your supreme weapon is killing. My supreme weapon is dying." Because when we are apart from these bodies, we go to be with the Lord. The Apostle Paul says, "For me," and he's in prison in Philippi, he says, "For me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain." So what of it? If Jesus has already suffered for us, why do we need to suffer? Joseph Son fondly remembers the words of an English theologian who said to him, "Jesus' cross was for the propitiation of sins. The believer's cross is for the propagation of the gospel." As we humbly and patiently wait on the Lord and sing of his steadfast love, in the morning, it is going to be eye-popping for the watching nations. So stay true. Keep trusting. And let's sing aloud of God's steadfast love. I've brought my guitar